Good morning. Okay, so this is a very full weekend in the human realm. Happy Father's Day. I don't know if, anyway, we all have a dad, whether or not our dad is still here. So even if we're not a dad ourselves, we can still appreciate fathers today. It's also, I think we're still in the midst of Pride this month. And also today is Juneteenth. So there's a lot, you know, a lot up, I think. And I was thinking this morning with so much going on, our friend Wangari is singing all over the North Shore this weekend as part of Juneteenth celebrations. And so it's especially a good time to be practicing, to be grounding our body, mind, anchoring ourselves. And the word this morning that's coming up for me is equanimity, grounding ourselves in equanimity, particularly in our practice of chanting. The way of Zen chanting is a practice of equanimity. It's giving equal value to each syllable and also each space. Like there's a very regular kind of rhythm to our chanting. This is a very important aspect of our chanting, this aspect of equanimity, because it doesn't give so much value to personality and individuality, like where one person might take a breath as opposed to another person taking a breath. So this equanimity is also an expression of the communal, an invitation into the communal. That a Zen center is not a collection of individuals doing their thing when they feel like it, how they feel like it. It's a beautiful invitation to give over, to get out of our siloed, mundane experience of aloneness, which is the shadow of, you know, the American view of individualism. No wonder there are so many lonely people. So this chanting, especially on Zoom, this is very challenging for those of you who are practicing as Kokyo to uphold the communal, even though it's only your voice being heard, at least by all of us. I mean, if you're chanting, you can hear your own voice where you are. But for us all to hear just one voice, the Kokyo, what the Kokyo is aiming for is that boom, 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 boom. You know, that not missing a beat because you're taking a breath. And that's hard to sustain that. You know, Avalokiteshvara Bodhisattva, when deeply practicing Prajna Paramita, clearly saw that all are empty and thus relieved all suffering. Shariputra, form does not differ from emptiness. Emptiness does not differ from self is emptiness. Emptiness, right? That's hard. It's a concentration practice. And it's also an equanimity practice, because giving equal value like that, it gives all of us a chance to join in with the Kokyo. So this is powerful, and this is a big deal. And last week, we really got to experience the fruit of sustaining such a practice during Zoom. It wasn't like a cold shower going back in and going, what? Wait, what do we do? Our bodies knew. Our bodies knew what to do. And so mark your calendar, July 24th. We are aiming for that to be in person. It's the next all-day sit for that also to be in person. And, you know, I just wanted to back up because maybe not everybody knows what Juneteenth is. And I just wanted to name it because it's only the second year that it's being acknowledged nationally, celebrated nationally. It used to be just limited to Texas. So June 19th, 1865. a Union general rode into Galveston, Texas, and announced that the Civil War had ended and enslaved people were free. This is wonderful, and it's also so telling that this was 2 years late. I mean, it was 2 years after. 2 years of not realizing that people were already free. And I feel like it's telling because there is this question about, you know, what is this freedom that we're talking about? Is it truly freedom? You know, I think many people might agree that this freedom that we're talking about is still aspirational. It's not, in fact, a reality yet. So I'm thinking about this morning. I'm thinking about liberation, freedom, and then also how, you know, 4th of July is coming up. And maybe, you know, this shifts. I wonder if it could be possible that we could make the shift into Juneteenth being about freedom for all of us. Because there is this truth to no one is free if anyone's oppressed. You know, in this practice of non-duality, there cannot be any freedom. Like, we might even say that the enslaver is equally bound. I mean, in some ways, in some very important ways, the enslaver is just as bound as the enslaved. So could we shift into seeing this freedom that we usually associate with 4th of July being more connected with Juneteenth, and that the 4th of July might be connected with interdependence? I think this is really important, this dance of both freedom and interconnectedness, interdependence. It's our freedom, not as individual, just individuals, disparate individuals, but freedom within the truth of our interconnectedness with each other. So it's not freedom like I can do whatever I want. I can use a gun whenever I want and however I want. But it's freedom within this responsibility for each other. This responsibility, taking responsibility for our actions of body, speech, and mind, and how they impact everyone. And they're impacted by everyone. So if we start to see it like that, I mean, it really shifts things. I'd love to keep studying this with you. You know, especially this time of year, June 19th, Juneteenth, going into 4th of July. So, and there's this quote that I just recently came across. You know James Baldwin? Does everybody here know James Baldwin? Wonderful philosopher, writer, poet, an artist, an artistic soul. He was African-American, part of like the Harlem Renaissance, and really a big presence in the 60s. He was also a gay Black man in New York. And here's something that he said. I think that the inability to love is the central problem, because that inability masks a certain terror. And that terror is the terror of being touched. And if you can't be touched, you can't be changed. There's so much here. I think that the inability to love is the central problem, because that inability masks a certain terror. And that terror is the terror of being touched. And if you can't be touched, you can't be changed. So the corollary, does it work this way? Of this might be, if you can be touched, you can be changed. Mm-hmm. One of the great joys of last Sunday for me personally and being at the library is being able to touch people again during Zazen with permission to be able to touch. And I feel with some people especially how profound this is, to be touched with disinterest. Now that's a very important word. Disinterest does not mean a lack of interest. It means a lack of an agenda. Disinterest does not mean uninterested. It means, no strings attached. And I do think about this, like if you're partnered and, you know, like my sister and I used to do this. We used to give each other back rubs. It was always understood if you gave one person the back rub that you got to get a back rub. And so it's like I always wanted to go second. I wanted to give the back rub first and then be able to just enjoy receiving a back rub. And there's a little bit of a contract here, you know, if that happens. So I often feel I really love to be able to touch unconditionally. And actually, when I touch you physically, you know, and it's on the shoulders and the upper back, and it is another version. It's like the Kyosaku of the new millennium, the stick. It's like the same intention of the stick. That stick is meant to be encouraging, but it's very easily misconstrued and can very easily be abused, can be an instrument of control. But at its heart, I feel, and I have experienced the Kyosaku, boom, boom, as being like something that I yearned for in the long sesshins that we would sit. Oh, it was so nice. It was such a release to be touched like that. But at a certain point, we stopped using it. And Blanche started giving little shoulder rubs. And I started kind of modifying that to just sort of kind of an encouragement to lengthen the spine. And to lengthening the spine means opening from behind, opening the spine, opening the chest, opening the heart. And for some people, this is profound because maybe they're not touched in this way, or maybe they connect on some level with the bodily experience of opening the heart. Maybe that's connected with feeling how their heart is quite closed most of the time. And so that's very sobering. It's so solemn, you know, to realize another way of being, living with an open heart, especially maybe after living years with a closed heart. This is really deep stuff. And so I'm feeling today the massive container of a regular practice schedule, a regular practice place, you know, where this is just happening all the time. It's so countercultural, you know, to just all we're doing here really is asserting, open your heart. Don't give up on love. Don't succumb to the terror. Allow yourself to be touched. And so I shared yesterday that I had this thought sitting in someone else's practice place. It's awesome. You know, it's really awesome to not confuse devotion with fanaticism, to be devoted to a single practice. To not be distracted by, you know, shopping around. I think there's a period of just sort of exploration. But some of us just kind of that allows us to stay on the surface for our whole lives. It's called spiritual materialism. It's really a gift to be able to find a practice and settle in it, settle into it. You know, because in that settling, you might find freedom. And again, the freedom, the true freedom that's not about preference. I can have what I want, when I want, how I want. That is not freedom. That's the great con of capitalism. That has nothing to do with freedom. That's just a different kind of tyranny. You know, how is it in the is it the Declaration of Independence? I'm really sorry that I'm so ignorant about this, but the pursuit of property, did that get amended to the pursuit of happiness? Or did one get taken out? We should research that, because that's a big difference, right? The pursuit of property as opposed to the pursuit of happiness. At any rate, this practice of ours, this thoroughgoing kind of regular practice of embodied witnessing, taking a seat, which is like taking your place in the mandala, in this circle of belonging, bearing witness. You know, and this bearing witness is, there's nothing neutral kind of about it. I mean, I guess in some ways there is a neutrality to it, but we're completely implicated in this bearing witness. This is part of the problem of that phrase, bearing witness. For me anyway, it evokes a kind of separation, a kind of I'm over here witnessing, clinically detached. That's not what I feel we're doing. That's maybe the falling a little bit too much on the side of the cool, detached, oneness. I don't know. It doesn't really give enough space for the heat of what James Baldwin is talking about. The heat, the fire. What was the book he wrote? Fire on the Mountain? Or the fire, this, you know, I always confuse it with Thomas Merton's. This, you know, the visceral quality of this terror, of the fear of being touched, the fear of loving, the fear of being changed. That's messy and complex and, you know, vulnerability inducing. Anyway, at any rate, this witnessing that I'm talking about, this bearing witness, is whole-bodied. It's emotional. It's fiery. That we are touched in our practice, hopefully. Someone wrote a book called If You're Lucky, Your Heart Will Break. That you are so profoundly touched in the activity of stillness, that there's no more fighting against the truth of suffering. And that this truth of suffering doesn't mow us down. So it's both feeling it and not being overpowered by it. So it's a kind of courage, a kind of fearlessness to just be in it. So this is, you know, and just be in it, we will be changed. So, but it's motivation to change the world from the inside out, that it's because we're being changed too. We're not separate from the world. So I did have this thought. I thought, because, and it's also what's up right now, is that our mission statement, we've chosen to accept it, this mission statement, And partially, we can accept it because the mission statement is a living document. It will keep changing. But we'll go through a process of changing it. It's more like we don't change it. It changes because we're changing, you know, collectively as we go forward together. We'll keep returning to our mission statement. Is it still true? Does this still ring true? But I was thinking in the context of this, of returning to our mission statement, which we're doing right now. You can see it on the website. It is there. And we're looking at it again because we respect, you know, the need to have a mission statement, respect to look again, respectare, to look again over and over and over again. So we're looking at it again. And what it's making me feel is that I feel this Zen Center, here it comes, is a vehicle. This Zen Center is a vehicle to save the world. And if that sounds too highfalutin, what about a vehicle to change the world? And if that sounds overwhelming, what about just a vehicle to deal with the world? Now, I hope that all of you relate with one of those. If it's just a vehicle to deal with the world, bravo, bravissima, excellent. That's enough. That's perfect. I mean, at least for some of you, it helped you to get out of bed in the morning, this morning anyway. So what we just chanted, to try to connect to this, I see it, and maybe you see it too. I don't know. Maybe I'm preaching to the choir here. But we just chanted the Eihei Koso Hotsugan Ron, right? What was that like for you to chant that? Did you chant it? And if you didn't chant it, what did you do? What were you doing during that time? Were you being indoctrinated? Were you drinking the Kool-Aid? Were you, checked out in some way? And if you weren't chanting it, it doesn't necessarily mean that you were checked out. Maybe you were connecting with your breath. Maybe you were listening deeply. Maybe you were allowing the words. Maybe you couldn't keep up with Seitetsu and you stopped chanting and you just opened to listening. And maybe you got curious about when she took her breath. And then you felt intimate with her because you were like, oh, that's not when I take my breath. I need to take breath more quickly than Seitetsu. Oh, I wonder how Seitetsu can go so long without taking. All of this for me is religious practice. All of this for me is engaging because you're here and you're present. This is the bearing witness. None of you logged off. And then in the words, because fortunately we have people who are translating Dogen Zenji's words from medieval Japanese into English. And we can hear things. So I'm going to go through this. Just see if any of this speaks to you. We were vowing this morning. Eihei Dogen was asking us to vow, to hear the true Dharma. To hear the true Dharma, to open to truth, to receive truth, and to be changed by this. To allow no doubt to arise, to open and to let it in. And to meet it. To meet this truth, to meet this true Dharma, to renounce worldly affairs. What are these worldly affairs that we're being asked to renounce in receiving truth? You know, I mean, for me this morning, renouncing one worldly affair is maybe it's the foundational one, this sense of separation, of a disconnect around what freedom is. The freedom is, you know, I'm free to do what I want and screw you, basically. This siloed living. And Dogen Zenji says that when we renounce these worldly affairs, these worldly views, the great earth and all living beings will attain the Buddha way. When we stop believing in separation, when we have another look at what is this freedom we're talking about? What is Juneteenth? What is it to wait 2 years to be told you're free? What do I do with all those 2 years? Were they wasted time? And then he says, and this is very important, although our past evil karma has greatly accumulated. I used to be completely like turned off by this. I gave rise to great doubt when I heard this. It sounded like I was about to go into the confessional and recite a few Hail Marys or something, you know. Our past evil karma, what? And I'm thinking about this as a door opening into the solidarity around the nature of good and evil. That it's an invitation to reconnect with our own, you know, evil, our own transgressions. You know, we might see it as an invitation to look at whether or not we're ready to meet our own transgressions with wisdom and compassion. You know, a Dharma talk I heard yesterday, I was thinking about it. There was something about it that left me unsettled. It was actually very clear and helpful and wonderful. And I think maybe we should all, not just Dharma teachers hearing other Dharma teachers' talks, but, you know, with what mind are you receiving this Dharma talk? Hopefully it's, you know, some measure of openness and some measure of, what's she really saying and how am I receiving it? Only a Buddha together with a Buddha. So yesterday I had the thought, there's this beautiful expression of mindfulness as light, shining light, as if in a dark room. And the question I have is there any value in darkness? Can we see value in darkness? Or do we relegate darkness to some realm of other? We say, sure too, we haven't chanted in a while. Wait, what is it that we say? When we say it at some point, is it the harmony of, do we chant the harmony of difference and equality? Light and dark oppose one another like front and back foot and walking. That's all. My right foot's not better than my left foot. I mean, actually right now, my right foot is better than my left foot. I have the swollen left foot right now. So in some ways it is true. But basically, back to this equanimity, we're just walking here. Light is shining and then the sun sets. I mean, on a bodily level, this truth that Dogen's talking about, we might experience it as just the simple activity of breathing. We breathe in and we breathe back out again. We need both, especially when I think about, I've been thinking lately about breathing in this moment, breathing out this moment. You know, I say this a lot to you guys. Opening the sense gates, breathing in the sounds, breathing them back out again. In other words, allowing their nature to be as it is, impermanent, ever-changing. So, breathing in the world, breathing it back out again. I'm finding it very helpful to see it this way. Breathing in the world, not rejecting it, taking it in, okay, all of it. And breathing back out again. It's like I got the whole world in my hands and I fling it up. It's a beautiful beach ball. And here it comes back down again. This is what I've been talking about this week with my rant on curiosity. I'm so tired of curiosity. I'm much more curious these days about playfulness. Seeing the whole world as this big beach ball in my hands. And boom, there it is in the blue sky. Oh, here it is in my hands again. I have no idea how that lands with you. All right, where are we? 8:59. I am going to end in a moment. Can I end on a big note? Let me just read James Baldwin again. I think that the inability to love is the central problem, because that inability masks a certain terror. And that terror is the terror of being touched. And if you can't be touched, you can't be changed. This inability to love, how do we learn to love? I have 4 points for those of you who like lists. One is maybe, first of all, appreciate how we don't love. How there are moments when we don't love, we can't love, we refuse to love, we shrink back. We hold back. To appreciate that, to let that in. And then the second thing is to see love as a practice. You know, not so much something to get, but something to give. Well, both an expression of Dana Paramita, this giving and receiving of love. To give this practice of giving and receiving love energy. Attention, curiosity, playfulness. And the third one is to value giving love, not just receiving love. And then the fourth one is to simply enjoy it, to notice it when it's here, to fully take it in when it's here. So I would like to say, I would like to offer this morning of Juneteenth, as we head into 4th of July, maybe this is an intention for me as we end, we're at the end of the practice period here. I believe we're in the final week or so, maybe the final week or two of this practice period, to let your practice be the ground of love. To let your practice be the ground of love, a celebration of both freedom and interconnectedness. I think that's a bodhisattva's expression of love. And then back to the Ehekoso. So for some of us who, when we think about love, might think about sexual love and all the complications there, romantic love, or even familial love, the complications of love. Parents with children, with siblings. And maybe we could just, how about this? Think about ancestral love, the love from our ancestors. The Dogen is asking us to open to with the Ehekoso Hotsukanmon. Practicing this love with the example of our ancestors, the ones who came before us, of our connection with them. Dogen says, they are just as we. And we in the future, he says, will be just as they. He says their compassion for us frees us from karmic effects, those transgressions he was talking about a few minutes ago. evil karma. Their love for us, their compassion for us, their solidarity with us not only frees us from karmic effects, but it fills the boundless universe with the virtue of their enlightenment and teachings. And then we're asked by Dogen to quietly explore all of this. That means right here in your practice of zazen, in your posture of zazen, with this open-heartedness, this is where you begin, right here. I think this is Dogen's way of talking about beginning with love right here, when he says, the true body of faith, the true mind of faith. All right, that's what I have to offer this morning. Thank you for listening. You know, I think the regularity of all of this, doing this over and over again, especially for those of you for whom zazen isn't yet discernibly, palpably a refuge. Maybe for those of you for whom zazen right now is more on the effort side, that it's hard to sit still, especially to you, I bow that you show up and you make this great effort to be still, to find the traction until you can find a little bit of release within this effort, a little bit of the connection between effort and release, between discipline and freedom, between interconnectedness and freedom. The true liberation